folks, and we are back. It is early September, just after Labor Day, Antifada. I believe this is episode 301. We had another guest lined up for today. That guest will be appearing in a week or two. But one of the advantages of living with and being married to one of podcast's greatest talents with one of the nicest voices, certainly one of the nicest laughs, I feel like, in show business. That is, of course, I mean, Rax King. One of the advantages is that if one of your guests, drops out or ghosts on you, you have a backup, and the backup is only ever about one room away. So welcome back to the show, my darling.
Yeah, welcome back to my own living room, to me.
With your own dog.
Yeah, glad to be back. Glad to be in the living room.
It's not often you get to guest on a podcast and Shug Pekingese is just standing right there.
I would argue that when I'm on most podcasts, which I record from this very apartment, she is standing right at my feet. Sometimes, you know, whining or demanding something inconvenient while I'm trying to have a conversation.
Yeah, well, she's not doing that right now. She's kind of swaying gently in the breeze in her old age. She gets very, very, very chill. So she's going to be a good girl. No barking this time, Shuggy.
She's like, I'll think about it.
She blinked at me. I think that means, okay, Dad. Listen, we have important stuff to talk about, and we have fun stuff to talk about today. Rax King, you're finished with your book tour, just about, right?
I am, yeah. I have a handful more like book festivals in a few weeks now, and then a couple other oddball events in the fall. But my long haul tour, such as it was, is over.
I like the idea of a long haul tour.
Long haul, like 2.5 weeks.
Yeah, but you know, that's long haul, right? We just got back from a bit of a trip, and we were at the Eastern Shore. Right. A place that you spent, I think, some quality time as a child. This is all a way of saying that this is going to be a podcast about Washington, D.C. Everyone. All right. Get your booze out now. Boo, D.C. Everyone's got an impression of D.C. and usually it's not great. But I think you're going to argue, and I'll back you up on this, that they are off base, because D.C. is more than just the Capitol building. It's more than just the White House. It's more than the Supreme Court of the United States. It's also a place where, I don't know, about 700,000 people live and are born and raised and grow up and live and work and create awesome hardcore music and eventually pass away. You are a denizen. You are a hometown girl. You are DC's finest, as we like to say here. It must feel pretty surreal these days to be watching what's happening down in DC with the federalization of the Metropolitan Police Department and the National Guard on the streets of your city. How do you feel at this very moment?
Oh, I mean, about that, bad. You know, in general, in my life, which I don't live in D.C. anymore, so most of what I do happens in this apartment in Brooklyn, and things, for me, kind of couldn't be going better. But then, you know, I still have a lot of friends, and I have some family who still live in D.C., and it's fucked up. It's like really fucked up vibes down there right now. If not even illegal, if people do anything even a little bit annoying, they're just immediately set upon by this like cursed combination of, you know, Metropolitan Police, various federal agents, mm-hmm. like National Guard guys, just, you know, if you litter on the sidewalk, 10 of those guys are immediately at your side, just so fucking grateful for something to do.
Yeah.
Because there's just like, they're so crazy many of them right now.
Yeah, it's a real freaky, creepy scene, it looks like, down there. I haven't been since the federalization of the police force and all that stuff going on. But we're going to talk DC today. And shout out to Anders Lee for doing this before us. Several weeks ago, he was on this podcast. He was born, I believe, in D.C. and had a lot to say about what the city is going through at this time. We're going to follow up with that, not to replace Anders Lee, but to supplement him.
Well, I could never replace Anders Lee.
The two of you are like kind of comrades in arms. You're holding forth. You're letting the people of this country and this world know that D.C. is not just the empire, the beating heart of the terrible empire. It's also filled with real people. So thank you for coming on today to talk about it.
Yeah, totally. I feel like a little foreign exchange student or something, like come to report on the customs of my people.
Well, it is kind of like that, I have to say, because D.C.'s had home rule now for, I guess, over 50 years or so. D.C. is a strange little carve out that's in the Constitution that says basically you're not a state. You are a city, but you're not a state. You don't get any congressional representation. No senators, zero senators. You get one congressperson who you're allowed to elect, but they don't get any votes on anything. And so the people of D.C. are often addressed as these kind of weird Morlock types. They don't have any representation. They're like these like strange people who are these permanent residents of this place that's very transient, right? I'm sure you'd agree with that. You have, of course, politicians coming and going, but also their staffers and think tankers and students and things of that sort. So I really do feel like we need to present the Anders Lees and the Rax Kings of the world to the rest of the world and say, hey, guess what? There are real people that live here. It's got a real culture. It's got almost a million people. It is a real place. So I know it is a heavy crown to wear, but you're wearing it today.
I mean, I'm not sure that if you want to make the point that DC is a place full of normal, everyday people, I don't know that comedian Anders Lee and I are the people to wheel out for that task. I mean, we also don't even live there anymore. Yeah. Like, part of DC being such a transient place, like its professional class is really transient. Every new election, there are these huge shifts in the professional ecosystem there. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of ripples out so that even if you don't work in the, I don't know, the native industries of Washington, like if you're not in politics, if you're not, you know, working for a lobbyist or a think tank or tourism, journalism, I guess, like the handful of industries that comprise the city's professional and administrative center, even then, it's so unpleasant to like have your whole city's ecosystem devoted to those fucking people that a lot of natives leave. Like they just get sick of functioning like extras in their own city.
Right. Yeah, you know, I have to say, and I kind of felt this way before I knew you, but I definitely feel this way now that, you know, I live with and in love with and married to a DC person. But like, I don't know, I feel as though maybe in a way I've only experienced before with people from Quebec. The people of DC walk around with this giant bulging chip on their shoulder. And I personally find that very charming. I find it very nice when people are really mad about stuff. That's why I don't talk shit about Staten Island, because you know what? They have a right to be pissed off and they have a right to be terrible. So let them be, you know? That's kind of how, I'm not saying you're the Staten Island of Northeastern cities.
No, you're saying I'm the Quebec of, of Northeastern cities.
So I guess my question to you is, comment ça va? How does it feel to be French?
I mean, like, okay, so I would imagine that some part of this is like analogous to the Quebecois experience. A big part of why DC has so few people who like their families have been living there for generations is, you know, people keep continuously getting priced out. And especially now that living in a city center is like once again a desirable thing, it's no longer, well, I guess it's, this is sort of shifting, but for about 20 years now, it's been a desirable thing to live at the city center, like in the heart of everything. And so for DC, that means that, you know, it's a small place, only so many places to live. And you've got also secondarily that rule that like no building can be taller than the Washington Monument.
Right,
so
right.
There's, you know, vanishingly few places to live, and they get snapped up more and more by these fucking ghouls who then, you know, the entire time they're working in my city, have the fucking gall to do shit like deploy the National Guard there,
right,
send a bunch of fucking FBI agents on night patrol there.
Yeah.
Like, y'all are forcing us out while you're forcing us out.
Not to mention the terrible Trump 2.0 fashion that these, like, little Hitler youth fascist kids who are the staffers show up and impose upon the city.
God, every time this happened with Trump, you know, with his first administration too, these like far right nut jobs come into power and we have to suffer through all these like New York Magazine profiles, like the darlings of the new right. Are these the most fashionable people you've ever seen? And then it's a picture of some like drunk asshole in khakis. I like the absolute indignity of me having to not only deal with these guys' policy, I also have to fucking look at them.
Yeah, I know. And you had to grow up with people wearing Sperry's, Docksiders, and pleated khakis and all that shit. But lest you think this is going to be just a 1 hour long airing of grievances.
Which it could be.
It could be. I mean, the Gripe Zone. We all remember the Gripe Zone from your podcast, of course, Low Culture Boil. This could be a Gripe Zone, but we're not here to bury DC. We're here to celebrate some portions of it. Yeah. If I could speak from the heart now about DC, I don't think that I ever jumped on the bandwagon of hating on DC.
I would be able to smell it on you.
Yeah, I never did that. I mean, I think because in the 90s, back in the day, DC was like a well-known place for punk and hardcore. And it was part of like the circuit that bands would do up and down the East Coast of the United States, especially the Northeast. And so there was always, when I was growing up, a grudging respect for DC as a place that had a tremendous punk and hardcore scene. As I know now, as you've introduced to me, also, of course, it's got a great go-go scene, too, which is, if people don't know, and maybe we'll put some, what, Charles Brown is the famous guy?
Chuck Brown.
Thank you. Charles is Chuck.
Charlie Brown. Are you thinking of Peanuts?
I might be. My brain feels like kind of a peanut right now. Right, Shug? So, yeah, go-go and punk and hardcore, obviously Discord Records, right, come out of this city. And for me, that's the real touchstone of like of its reality, of its real people. Even just having been a visitor a bunch of times in the 90s, in the 2000s, 2010s, it always struck me as a real place. And so we celebrate that. Talk a little bit about you know, the amazing civil society and culture that exists in DC that's under threat right now, really, is why we're talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, DC is truly a beautiful, special place. And just to get like very, very remedial about its positioning for anyone who's like either not from the US or just fairly enough does not give a shit about this sort of thing generally, DC is not a state. And as my husband's already said, our congressperson does not get a vote in Congress. I honestly am not entirely sure what her function actually is, except that she's had it for like 60 years.
Yeah, she's like ancient, right?
She's the oldest person ever. Like, I'm not convinced that a weekend at Bernie, whatever. Point being, like,
would it even matter if it was a weekend at Bernie's?
I mean, kind of not. Like, yeah, I hate to be a hater, but, you know. But because of this like kind of no man's land role that it's forced to play, Washingtonians are some of the most like bitter, sarcastic, but like funny people.
Yeah.
Which is something I like really appreciate. Like to this day, wherever I go, when I meet Washingtonians, which happens kind of frequently because I got a big old DC flag tattoo on my bicep. So anywhere I go, they are like, they are drawn to me.
Yeah.
And they all have that exact same, like, wry, funny, you know, very low-key, not fawning or glad-handing way about them. Like, they're not super friendly, but I really like them anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, ways that this plays out civically, I mean, our fucking default license plate there, like, if you get a car, your license plate frame is going to say taxation without representation, because we're like, well, let's just be passive aggressive about it. It's illegal and we have to do it anyway. So let's be incredibly passive aggressive about it.
I think I remember when that happened, when they came out with that under the George Bush administration, W. Bush administration. They were mad, so mad, but there was nothing they could do. It. One of the few things that DC had was a motor vehicle department.
Exactly. And like anytime we are able to do something like bitchy and annoying like that. Like, I mean, I'm no fan of Mayor Muriel Bowser.
Oh, we'll talk about her. Yeah.
Yeah. She's a, you know, not a fan of her, but I mean, during the George Floyd protests, she did have the ability to declare a Black Lives Matter plaza, I believe it was. And that's another like not super effective, but very gadfly obnoxious thing that DC's elected officials are able to accomplish.
Yeah, screw you, official Washington, right? Like, they're, in a way, I feel like the rest of the country is kind of like caught up with the DC mentality when it comes to the government, because like DC people, even after home rule, you know, as you were growing up, felt disenfranchised, were disenfranchised, felt as though the government that was ruling over them, the Congress, which they didn't even have a chance to vote for, was illegitimate. Now, and whether we like it or not, Trump is a reflection of this. More and more people in this country, maybe half of the people in this country and more growing by the day on the other side of the aisle, feel that this government is illegitimate, that this system is illegitimate. So in a way, we're like catching up to DC. You guys understood that a long, long time ago, and now we're all kind of living it, right?
Yeah, and I mean, to what you're describing, you know, the very day that Trump essentially declared martial law,
right. I
mean, we can, you know, we can disagree on the exact meaning of that, but he sent federal troops into DC. That sends a message. And the very day that happened, like, at least a dozen mutual aid organizations and funds that I'm aware of, which means probably many more small ones, mobilized like instantly. I mean, everybody, it was like all of these organizers had bug out bags packed and ready to go. Yeah. Like they were on the streets doling out, you know, supplies to people whose encampments were about to be swept, you know, arranging hotel rooms for them. Every time ICE strikes, you know, it seems like you look at videos of it and there's like 10 people filming, you know, if not more.
Cop watch.
Yeah, cop watch. And cop watch is, you know, very robust down there right now and very like detailed. I mean, I think we watched a documentary about DC music that it was really, you know, there was a lot of archival footage because Washingtonians are famously neurotic about documenting fucking everything.
Sure.
And so, you know, what I'm saying is that DC's people, because of their, almost because of how used to disenfranchisement they've had to get, they've known small and useful ways to take care of each other for a very long time. Like a lot of the orgs that I've seen in action were put together, you know, decades ago. I mean, HIPS has been playing a huge part there, and I'm embarrassing myself not being able to remember what that acronym stands for. But they've been around for, I believe, decades. Like Food Not Bombs, they've been everywhere for a really long time. So all of these, I guess, community care infrastructure has been like really well used there, really efficient and easy to mobilize. And that's something that like growing up there, you saw play out in so many different ways. I mean, public services in DC are really robust and, you know, really like community minded too. Like the public library there puts on go-go shows and hardcore shows. They have a punk archive. Mm-hmm. Like it's a really community minded place.
I ran across a very interesting statistic that bears this out, which is that Washington, D.C. has the highest percentage of Americans in the country with health insurance, because the city of D.C., using the meager funds that they have that they're appropriated to them and that they get through taxation, are able to supplement whatever insurances people have or don't have, which I think expresses, you know, what you're saying here. It's an example of that. And I think that you're right. There's this layer, right, it seems like, of NGOs and other bodies, nonprofits, that arose in the 70s and I think especially in the 80s under Reagan and all the cuts that came from then. But then underneath that, too, and I think this is what really galvanizes me and makes me think positively of DC, but also kind of understand it maybe as like a vision of all of our futures, is that below that stratum of nonprofits and NGOs, which are tied to the Democratic Party or tied to the state or whatever, parastate institutions, there's also like a mutual aid network that's more than just like, you know, 10 anarchists sitting in a room somewhere, which is fine if that's you. But
like, your org is really effective.
Your org
if they describe you.
You should keep doing what you're doing. But DC's much vaunted scene, whether it's go-go or whether it's hardcore, I think is a real expression of like civil social solidarity and mutual aid kind of existing on a mass scale in the city. Again, going back to like the industrial crises of the, of course, the riots of the 60s, the industrial crises of the 70s, the crack epidemic of the 1980s, Reaganism, obviously the gentrification of the 90s and the 2000s. There's been this robust sort of civil social undercurrent to things. So I think that's what you're getting at, right? And this is something you experienced too?
Yeah. And I mean, I guess I'm speculating here, but my instinct for why that civil social orientation is so strong in DC is that, you know, we've only had home rule for about 50 years. That's really, you know, there are people alive now who didn't grow up with it.
Right.
And so it's a fragile thing. And we've all seen, especially with this administration, what an unreliable partner the federal government is to all of us. And, you know, most of us have tacit representation. So in DC, you're growing up like from the jump knowing that the federal government is unreliable. Yeah. It is not there to take care of you. To the extent that you figure into its planning, like you don't want their eyes on you ever. It's like having the fucking eye of Sauron on you.
Seriously.
And so we've, you know, I think become accustomed to seeing ourselves as the sort of like redheaded stepchild yeah. of America. And I mean, I feel like maybe what I'm saying makes it seem like I have a utopian view of the place. I certainly don't. Mm. There's a lot of like, I mean, the city used to be majority black. Those numbers are being depleted every year because of how expensive it's gotten to yeah. live there. So, you know, de facto segregation is coming back. That said, I mean, I look at these ICE Watch videos, these Cop Watch videos, and I'm really encouraged to see that in no one video does everyone look the same. Mm-hmm. You know, there's people from all different strata, moms in Lululemon yoga pants and like young teenagers and shit, and they're all fighting against the same enemy. And that, to me, despite its imperfections, is what DC is. It's like, even in good times, we're a place that kind of sees the federal government as the enemy.
Right, yeah. And again, we're all kind of catching up.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I want to touch on a subject that I think a lot of people shy away from, and for good reason. It's a very uncomfortable topic, but it is the topic at hand, because when Trump federalized the local police and when he sent the National Guard in to harass people with sandwiches and playing basketball and whatever and fill in the high profile tourist destinations in the city, it was for a reason. And the reason was crime. He it's under his right. I think of the it comes from the 1973 Home Rule Act. It is the president, the executive's right to declare a state of emergency. And so several weeks ago, he declared a 30-day state of emergency because of crime. Now, we have to be, you know, very clear-eyed about this. We can't deny that crime exists. Crime certainly exists. Just to talk about and to acknowledge crime, people on the left are like, oh, well, you're like you agree with the carceral state or like what? We can admit that crime is a thing in D.C. Talk about your experience with crime. You grew up, I think, after the great crack epidemic of the 1980s. By like the 1990s, it seems like things had calmed down a bit. But crime does exist in DC, right?
Yeah, I mean, one kind of crime, I guess, I think it's worth drawing people's attention to. It's unpleasant to think about, but it's skyrocketed in the past just month or so. And that's violent crimes against guys who call themselves big balls.
I think we've seen 100% increase.
At least. It used to never, ever happen. And all of a sudden, it's happening so much that apparently, okay, it does not make our country look strong.
I have a question, though. If a big balls gets beat up in the forest and nobody hears
are his balls really beat?
Yeah, exactly.
I just, like, Trump has now called in the national, I've lost count how many states, I think it's like five or six states have been asked to send National Guard troops to D.C. to combat this emergency level crime. Mm. And D.C. is a city of, you said 700,000 some odd people.
Yeah.
So my question is, how is anybody supposed to feel like you are like big man in charge, like really fighting crime good, if you have to call in so many thousands upon thousands of people to deal with crime in a city that has like no one living in it,
with all their tactical, like their armor plates and their right? giant fucking machine guns, and like they're wearing their desert camo and shit.
Totally, like showing up to the basketball court at like 9 o'clock of an evening, peering in folks' cars and just getting their shit roasted for yeah. looking like a passel of douchebags. This makes you look like a turd person,
turd man, like turd army.
How do you not? How is this not embarrassing to you? I understand that what they're saying is all bullshit, any justification. And what's really, you know, the game here is to impose and intimidate and show all these quote unquote blue cities who's boss. Like, I do get that.
Yeah.
But even by your own rhetoric, using your own logic.
By your own logic, sir.
Yeah. You look like the biggest jackass. Right now.
Yo, it was so cool, that footage of the National Guard, and they're wearing their desert camo, which, first off, in a city like LOL, but also they're picking up trash, so they've got reflective high-vis vests on.
Yeah, seriously.
You look like an asshole. You look like such an asshole.
I'm truly sorry that you got called away from the Foot Locker that you are assistant manager of. No, I shouldn't guys who are the assistant manager of a Foot Locker.
It's not their fault, but you are right that there is a type of weekend warrior guy who I'm sure is like super hyped to go to DC and flash a gun around, go into like the enemy camp or whatever. And, you know, there's so much in this country, not just today, but for decades, maybe centuries, of like hating on cities. And DC gets it real good, of course, mm-hmm. because... you know, all these ghoulish politicians who come from shitty, again, we got to watch ourselves, that come from rural districts. Maybe they've never been to a city in their life. All of a sudden they represent this rural district and they end up in DC, and they can go back and tell their constituents how terrible it is. And depending on who their constituents are, how black it is, how scary it is, right. how much crime there is. So DC is like a perfect foil, I think, for people to be able to... you know, use it as a test case, as you say.
Yeah, and actually, like, now that we're talking to that point, my instinct, too, is to, like, never shit on anyone else's home.
Yeah.
Largely because my home gets so shit on by everybody. Like, it's glass not a houses. Nice thing to do.
Yeah.
However, at this point, I'm like, well, shit, y'all aren't worried about offending me. Maybe your home is kind of a shithole. Maybe you generate way too many giant white men with that fucked up little pone of fat in the back of his bald ass head who's got fantasies about the apocalypse and goes off and buys 75,000 guns off of QVC and then imposes his ass on my hometown. And maybe I don't need to worry about offending people who think that's a cool thing to do. Maybe y'all need to toughen up.
Yeah.
My people are fighting stormtroopers. Like, what are you doing in your and little suburban house?
And they're fighting them with foot-long sandwiches.
With Subway sandwiches, yeah.
I don't know if people saw that video, but I first saw that video. I think you watched it on repeat for about 3 hours straight. And I was like, hey, what you looking at? You're like, sandwich guy.
Well, you found out about it. I was in Seattle. I will never forget where I was when I found out about sandwich
it's
guy.
It's like your 9/11.
Yeah, but it's like good 9/11.
Yeah, so 9/11.
What if 9/11 was like really cool and fun for me?
I'm kidding. I don't think 9/11 was good, folks. Stems is jokes.
I was in Seattle. It was my Seattle Stop a Book tour. And I had just been on a really long walk around like a lake near where I was staying.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I hadn't been looking at my phone for hours, and I felt so serene and so peaceful. And then I opened up some social media app, and the first thing that showed up was a video from the night before.
Yeah.
Of this of this like beanpole white man wearing a pink, like a pastel pink button-down shirt and khaki shorts. Classic type of DC going out white guy. And what he was doing in the video was screaming at these feds, like, fascist, yeah. fascist, and they were not reacting. And then he threw a foot-long sandwich at one of them at point-blank range, like, hucked his sandwich at the guy's bulletproof vest.
It was like a fragmentation grenade, too. Like, it had, like, a solidity to it. And it hit this guy. It hit him directly in the chest and, like, lettuce and all the right. toppings from the Subway sandwich.
It was like a pinata.
Yeah, just flew everywhere.
And then he just kind of jogged off at a... you know, at an at a reasonable pace.
And the fat fucks were behind him and couldn't even catch
they couldn't
him.
I don't know that they ever did catch it, but like they, that night. That they night found they him did, eventually. Yeah. I don't think they caught him that night.
And Sandwich Man, I think, was victorious. Judge dismissed. I think they wanted to like get him for attempted murder of a federal officer.
Yeah, and everyone was like, no.
We saw, we all
under
saw
the come
video.
On defense. Yeah, he got a ROR. He went home, and yeah. I think he might, if they can get a grand jury to fucking indict him,
in DC.
Which has, you know, they tried once and nobody would indict him.
Yeah. No, I mean, if Marion Barry got off light, he's getting off light too.
That, and that's the thing, actually. There's a perfect through line between Marion Barry, who was caught in an FBI sting operation smoking crack in a hotel room.
If you're too young for that story, go ahead, look it up. The video's out there.
It's a great story. But, you know, Marion Barry was also the black mayor of D.C. who had like a very popular summer jobs program for at-risk kids. And, you know, maybe there was a secondary reason the FBI really wanted to catch him smoking crack in a hotel room. And anyway, when they caught him, D.C. was like, we don't, even Ian MacKay, of like, who wrote the song Straight Edge, was interviewed being like, they came after him, man. And it's true. And D.C. was like, they elected him mayor again. He's mayor for life, officially. He was like city councilman until the day he died. And that's how Washingtonians are going to be about Sandwich Guy.
And you know what? Marion Barry in the headlines for like getting caught smoking crack, being set up by the fucking feds. Smoking crack with a woman of the night. That all, I remember when that happened, and it all existed on the same plane as Donald Trump and all his bankruptcies,
right,
and all of his ex-wives and all of that drama. Like, that was all like a mishmash in like the late 80s, like early mid 90s or whatever. And so truly we keep getting brought back. But I would say that, say what you want about Marion Barry, mayor for life of DC, he walked so that Rob Ford, the crack mayor of Toronto, could run.
He was such the better mayor,
the
though.
The better mayor.
That's the problem. Because now you've got, like, you just call them both the crack mayors, but yeah. One of the crack mayors was, you know, kind of good at his job, actually.
Yeah, one of the crack mayors provided jobs, summer jobs for kids, you know, so they wouldn't get into trouble using D.C. resources. And the other one, I don't know, got fat and smoked crack.
Yeah.
I don't know what else Rob Foy did. Probably something terrible. I think
he was kind of terrible, but it's escaping me what exactly he did.
Well, eventually he had a heart attack, so that's cool.
Oh, yeah.
He's kaput, yeah.
Oh.
His brother's around. I don't think his brother smokes crack. He's not cool enough.
Well, I wouldn't either if I...
Knowing what he knows.
Yeah, you don't hear about the other Biden smoking crack either.
The idea... All right, so like we all understand this as a political maneuver, right? We all understand that, and of course, crime statistics can be juiced. And of course, crime, as much as it's an objective thing, is also kind of a subjective thing. It's like, do the residents of an area feel safe? And that's more than just like the bottom line, how many crimes happened of whatever types, right? And it has a lot of subjective feel to the whole thing. Regardless, we understand that this is a pretext. Right, yeah. For a political move. Andy said on the previous Antifada episode with Anders Lee that D.C. is becoming like Los Angeles before it. You know, we remember that the National Guard. God, if you're listening to this 10, 20 years in the future, first the National Guard went to Los Angeles to defend ICE as they did all their raids. And then the National Guard went to D.C. So you probably...
And now they're going to Chicago.
Yeah, you're going to be privy to all the places they go after that,
right.
After this. And that was kind of Andy's point, was that Big Balls is, of course, Doge. And Doge is, of course, like Silicon Valley kind of tech fascist influence within this administration, which still exists, obviously. And so DC then is like a setup. Like, they're setting this up as like this new model, this like Silicon Valley fascist model around the country. That's what Andy said. But all that being said, like the crime is real. Like, we can admit that the crime is real. And crime in capitalist society is a reflection of the class system, right? It's one of these things that arises, of course, when you have workers who are employed, workers who are unemployed, workers who are semi-employed, and like a virulent capitalist class, obviously, that loves to move money around and move jobs around, irrespective of the residence of a place. Crime happens. So we're not going to deny that whole thing. But it's really interesting, I think, the way that crime is being used, has been used by Trump from the very beginning to do all sorts of things that were considered, I think, that would have been considered out of the realm of possibility, even 10 years ago, right?
I mean, I'm not sure, like, if you look at the numbers in D.C. at least, I don't know about the other places he's sending the National Guard, but crime had been, you know, way down and had been trending down for years and is at a historic low. I don't know of how many years, but it's, you know, it's not an emergency. And I'm also not sure that it follows in any sensible way if DC had been having, you know, its worst crime year ever, and if people were just getting shot and carjacked in the streets like all these assholes want to say they are, I don't think it follows that this is the response that's needed. I don't think this is a response that would do anything in that scenario except add fuel to the fire. And I think the reason that things haven't gotten a whole lot uglier and a whole lot more real is that crime is so low. Right. People aren't out there like in a killing mood. Generally, people want to be left alone, and Washingtonians have always wanted to be left alone.
I don't quote me on the statistics, but I think I saw during COVID, or remember that crime spike? We all remember when that happened. Like during COVID, there were 3,000 incidents of violent crime broadly conceived in DC, and now there's like 1,000. So like there's been a substantial drop even just in the last few years, not even to mention like the bad times, you know, back in the 80s and 90s when New York City also had bad times, when cities all over this country had bad times. But yeah, I agree. Like even if it did have like the worst, like 1980s level, like crack war levels of crime, there's no justification for it. Part of like living in a quote unquote free society, a society free of tyranny, is that you're going to have many people who take up the freedom to do a crime, right? The freedom to deal with illicit substances, to fight over the spoils of illicit substances, to sell their bodies, to steal somebody's car. You know, this is, if you wanted to have a zero crime DC, it'd be very easy. You just, well, there's two options. The first would be to just put National Guard people with guns on every single corner and have them like arrest anyone that comes out of their houses and put them in a big giant camp somewhere, and then like
concentrate, you know, them heavily in some location,
in some lager, let's call it.
Sure.
In some lager, and then you'd have no crime. The other thing to do, if they're so concerned, and this is, I think, the nub of the problem, if they're so concerned about Washington, D.C. being like a faithful reflection of the great country, the country that has been made great again, right, in Donald Trump's second term. If it's supposed to be this jewel, if it's supposed to be like representative of the grandness and the greatness of the United States of America, why allow anybody to live there at all? You can just have nice, shining buildings. You can have the cleanest streets in the entire world. Just get rid of all of the D.C. citizens. Just make it illegal to live in D.C. People can come in and take, I don't know, buses or trains, or they can, I guess, drive in to the city every day to work and just have no residence at all. And that might make people, you know, the Trumpists, the MAGA people happy, I suppose. But it wouldn't be a city. It wouldn't be like part of society. You wouldn't have people doing anything. You wouldn't have a place,
right?
So like I that's what I mean by saying like part of freedom, part of like being able to determine what you're going to do on a day-to-day basis, is not having a guy with a machine gun standing on the street corner watching your every move.
Yeah. And also like they're not just watching. I mean, I will say, from what friends living there have told me, from footage I've seen, it sounds like the National Guard have been keeping to themselves pretty much, like aside from that one really funny day when they were all picking up garbage with gopher grabbers and shit. But the feds and ICE especially, and the Metropolitan Police Department, they've all like, they've got fucking carte blanche now. And I just like, it's, it's not just that this is intimidation. Like, delivery guys are being kind of stolen off the streets, and there are restaurants telling folks, don't order delivery.
Oh, yeah.
Because our guys are afraid. Like, nobody wants to leave their house. We looked at that video together of some kinds of feds. It's impossible to tell what agency anyone's from. They just wear vests that say police.
I know.
They hide their badges.
And they hide their faces.
Yeah, they hide their faces behind masks. But we saw that video of, you know, it was a basketball court in the evening, and this swarm of cops descended on this basketball court under the pretext that the park closes at sundown.
Yeah.
And this poor guy, he's filming, and he's like really funny, actually.
Yeah.
But what he's saying is, we can't even play basketball, which, like, the most harmless thing that people could be doing, playing a sport together in a publicly owned park, is being essentially made illegal. And, like, for all the videos we see of people fighting back in ways that are often very, very funny and enjoyable to see, you know, what we're not seeing is all the people saying, fuck this, I'm not leaving my house, I'm waiting for all this to blow over, and I'm gonna, you know, I have no choice but to watch my city become a ghost town for a while until the eye of Sauron turns someplace else.
Right, to Chicago or to New York, God forbid, right?
Well, Chicago is what he announced today, I believe.
Yeah, Chicago's in his sights. So this is maybe going to be good for people from Chicago to listen to, because at the end of this episode, you're going to give a bunch of those mutual aid organizations you were talking about, and we'll put them in the show notes. But first, you know, I started this off by saying we went to the Eastern Shore for your birthday. We went to Ocean City. It was really nice. We went on the boardwalk. You showed it to me for the first time. It's really nice. It's like not Jones Beach. It's like the opposite of Jones Beach, and that's okay. And that's okay. We went to Rehoboth or whatever. It was really nice to see where a young DC person might end up going on vacation and being around your people, because your people are not, you know, again, in the 5 over 1s or the 3 over 1s in the fancy parts of DC, but they're the kind of people that like have like shitty tattoos and go to the boardwalk to get spray painted shirts and shit.
Yeah, you actually got me a spray painted shirt.
I did.
I was in the market for one of those classic t-shirts that you get at the Ocean City Boardwalk, and it's got a bikini body airbrushed. I always want to say spray painted airbrushed on the front of it. Incredible fashions for any time of year, but apparently they don't make them anymore.
I went from t-shirt store to t-shirt store, and I thought it was funny to go up to them and try to explain it to the people that worked at these stores, because there's t-shirt stores everywhere. It's all like memorabilia, you know, and they sell like the funny shirts like fuck you, you fucking fuck,
right,
and the kind that's got
my
like,
favorite was
memes.
The one that said, my wife beats me. Why is that being manufactured? That's not like cute and fun,
no,
dude.
It's not cool. And then they had like booty shorts that said like, I like big dicks. Yeah. Shit.
There was one that said, I like white guys, which.
Cool, dude. Okay. Yeah. So I had fun with that. I went into all these places. I tried to describe to them what we wanted, you know, and, it turns out, and this would be interesting to look up, it turns out that many of the people working in these places are of Eastern European descent. I couldn't really tell if they were, there. Some sounded like they had Ukrainian or Russian accents, which we also saw in Miami, too.
Yeah.
Some of them seem like maybe Balkans, so they might have like H-1B visas for like... like painted on like t-shirt sellers or something.
Sure,
maybe they
yeah.
import them over from Montenegro or something to come work for the summer. But I had a good time trying to explain to them. They're like, no, we don't make this. And then finally I found a guy who like runs like his own stall thing, and he's like, I explained it to him, and he looked at me glumly and he said, yeah, we don't make those anymore. It's way too much work. He said, if you want one, I'll upcharge you and you can come pick it up tomorrow. I was like, yeah, no, I'm not doing that shit.
Yeah, and then I looked at those t-shirts, you know, after I couldn't get the bikini body one, I had to Google it mournfully for a while and imagine what could have been. And they don't look like all that much more work than, I don't know, the Confederate flag.
Of which there were many.
There were a certain number of samples of Confederate flag airbrush designs.
Yeah.
And
a very popular flash. Right?
Yeah.
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 You can get a Confederate flag, I guess, in your child's face together on a shirt. That's just a nice thing.
That's
it's
beautiful.
A nice, beautiful gift for your young, loved child. shows you really love them. But you didn't get a Confederate flag. You're not like that.
No, I got a DC flag, which the guy had never heard of before.
It's like a Confederate flag for certain people, though.
It's, you know, in its way, it's kind of a Confederate flag because it's a loser flag, but I'm very attached to it.
And it makes some people really mad.
That's right, yeah.
Hell yeah, so it's your own little Confederate flag. But that wasn't the only place that we went. You and I also went to a very important political rally. We went to a rally that really spoke to us and our beliefs. Thank you to my dad for bringing us to the Workers Over Billionaires rally. We went in we drove into downtown Wilmington, Delaware. Beautiful place, just kidding, in Delaware. And it was a rally. I'm not sure how we would describe the rally. It was definitely, it was thrown by the AFL-CIO.
A lot of union locals, like, sent groups of people there. You know, everybody in union memorabilia, which was nice.
Yeah, there were pipe fitters there. Yeah. There were electricians there. There were a lot of Ask Me. So that's government workers, and a lot of, there were some carpenters too, which was nice to see. Brickies, I think, were there too, the bricklayers. Yeah. So there was the building trades, and there was SEIU, and there was government unions, right?
Yeah. And teachers too, I believe.
Teachers, yeah, well represented. In fact, my stepmother's mother, who's in her 80s, was a teacher union member from way back when, in the 50s and 60s, and she came with us and had a sign. It was all very nice. That part of it was really nice. But describe the speakers, because we're not even 100 miles from DC, maybe 100 miles from DC, but it's pretty fucking close. Describe the speakers and the glaring omission that they left the center thing.
So I mean, it was mostly like people who probably also went to the DNC, like that branch of city officials. Yeah. And Delaware's one congressperson was there, Congresswoman Sarah McBride.
One of their two senators was there.
One of their two senators. I believe the governor was
there. Governor was there.
All of which is to say, you know, muckers. Like, yeah. Relative to how small of a place Delaware is.
Delaware has like a population of D.C.
Right,
it's like
a
small place.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was, you know, pretty high-level officials. And the turnout, I thought, was pretty decent. I mean, your dad and stepmom said they'd seen rallies with more.
The No Kings rally, I think, that the progressives threw like a month ago was, I think, bigger. They said 20,000.
Yeah, no one wants to go to a rally on Labor Day.
No.
Everybody was at their house like grilling.
Yeah.
But
if they were lucky. Not us, though. We were troopers.
But Congresswoman Sarah McBride, who, she's an interesting figure. I mean, she's the first openly transgender member of the House of Representatives, which I understand she's taken kind of a lot of abuse from
Nancy Mace,
Nancy
right?
Mace, yeah. And I want to say Marjorie Taylor Greene as well.
Lauren Boebert.
Yeah, the
typical
usual fucking suspects. Like, exactly who you'd think would be making a transgender congresswoman's life miserable.
Right.
But she got up to speak, and I don't even remember exactly how it was she phrased it, but the gist of what she said to, like, warm up the crowd and get them laughing was, you know, I've been blessed to be on recess from Washington, D.C., and, you know, sadly, I have to go back soon. Boo.
Right.
I don't think she literally booed, but that was
the
energy.
That was the impression, yeah. It was like, who would want to go back to a place like that?
And what she very pointedly did not say, and this is, you know, this is the DC populace's relationship with the federal government in a nutshell. She's up there, you know, using DC as a punchline because that's what's going to get laughs from people in a Wilmington, Delaware audience. She's not taking the opportunity to talk about this drastic overreach of executive power that is deploying all these agencies plus all these states' National Guard troops to D.C. for very obviously trumped up bullshit reasons.
Trumped up, yeah.
Didn't say a single word about it. Aside from one, I believe he was a union organizer.
He was the executive secretary treasurer of the local AFL-CIO.
Right. That was his role. He said a couple words about, you know, the occupation of D.C. Congresswoman Sarah McBride, who lives there a certain amount of the year while working in Congress, didn't even pay lip service to the idea that the residents of this place, that is essentially her second home, whether right. she likes it or not, might be suffering under the rule of the federal government right now. And that is why Washingtonians give so little of a shit about the federal government. It's why we don't trust them. It's why, you know, we were definitely as excited as anyone when Obama won. But I think, generally speaking, Washingtonians are ready at a moment's notice to be cynical about what's going on in the Oval Office and the Capitol building, because it almost never benefits us. Like, to the extent that they notice us at all, it's to give us grief. And by and large, they, you know, they eat in our restaurants. We're good enough to serve them. Yeah. We're good enough to sell them stuff in stores. Right. And we're good enough to dance in their strip clubs. We are not good enough to warrant consideration as part of the job they already have to do.
Right, right. Yeah, because literally they are your government. They are D.C.'s government. They Congress basically runs D.C., except for the small parts of home rule that exist. I would say, too, that, you know, we drove around Wilmington, Delaware. There's crime there. Guess what? You know, like, you didn't mention that it's happening in D.C. Maybe he comes to Wilmington next. I don't know why, of all the fucking places in this country, he'd choose the city of Wilmington to, you know, send the feds in to start to cause ruckus. But this could be coming to a town near you. So I would say that to her, too.
I think it's definitely coming to a town near you. I think that, like, if you are a Democratic congresswoman and also the first openly transgender congresswoman, which we all know, trans rights is one of this administration's pet issues. It's like a huge bugaboo for them. They fucking hate trans people in public. And so you'd think, in your official capacity, you'd really be looking for opportunities to express solidarity. And I think that's really what's needed now, because I think that, I mean, this president is a little bit of a crazy person, and the reasons he gives for the things he does are ludicrous and obviously made up. And so my point being, this probably is coming to a city near you in one form or another. And I think we all ought to be looking for opportunities to, you know, be in solidarity together and to offer support. And I will say, too, I recently did a fundraiser for some mutual aid funds operating in D.C., doing really good on the ground work. And I got donations up to, I think I stopped taking them at $2,000. And they were from people all over the country who, like, explicitly went out of their way to also say that, you know, they were expressing their friendship and solidarity. And I think that that's a really beautiful thing that we're all going to want to lean into on a community level and also on a national level, because, I mean, it's a cliche that we keep us safe, but we do.
Yeah, 100%. And I tell you, nothing more vindicates the work that you've been doing and I've been doing with the Independent Labor Club. Nothing more vindicates our idea of class independence and autonomy than going to a rally, a confected rally like the one we saw there in Delaware, Workers Over Billionaires. Because really, what was the political takeaway? What was the takeaway of the whole day? We heard it directly from several people. Make sure you get out and vote in 2026. Right. I don't know who you vote for if you're from D.C. Right. But, you know,
and also, 2026 in a year?
2026 is a long time,
and
bro.
Just hang tight and fuck just ourselves till then? And the, you know, the workers there, though, I mean, they were, you know, cheering for their reps, as I'm sure most people would in that situation. But it was really a nice thing to see that they were mostly there just to be together and to, you know, express what solidarity they were able to express that day in groups of people they knew and worked with and, you know, ran the city with. That really made me happy to see.
That was some of the good messaging that you got from that, right? And there is still this sense that, like, labor unions built this country and workers built the middle class and all this stuff. It's true, you know? The way in which this has been used, I think, to try to give legitimacy back to the Democratic Party, of course, is something that it was just so weird to see in person. You know, I'm used to this shit. I guess at union rallies in New York, it's the same thing. It's the same thing fucking everywhere.
At that level,
At that level. But it's so funny, the idea of Workers Over Billionaires. Like, everybody there knew. Everybody knows we have two billionaire parties.
Right. It's like we were all there kind of playing pretend for the sake of the elected officials. It kind of felt like going to see like a children's dance recital. Like what they were saying mostly was pretty good. Like underbaked.
Underbaked is being
a lot
very
of underbaked
generous.
Shit being served up at that rally. What? And we were all just like clapping like, good job.
Yeah, no, nice job. Thank you.
You made a speech all by yourself.
You, we're so proud of you, Senator Coons. The people of this country, I say that broadly, the voters of this country, the workers of this country, the middle class, everybody in this country is looking for someone to lead.
Yeah.
And with people like these, yeah. You know, like,
because they just see us as voters.
They see us as voters, and they want, of course, to continue to offer nothing. And they want to use this rhetoric of workers over billionaires and pretend that because of things that happened 80 years ago, that they are a workers' party.
Right. Keep getting elected, keep buying themselves time in between election and actually being expected to do something.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's all just filibustering, and that was very clear. But it's, you know, I'm glad that we went. I'm always glad when I go to things like that because I see it as like an anthropology thing, you know, and it helps to like vindicate maybe some of our more outro theories to actually go and see that like the labor movement, to the extent that it still exists in this country, is an adjunct, is like a junior partner of the Democratic Party.
Totally.
And you know, we would be remiss now if we didn't mention too that the other big thing that's happening in DC is all these layoffs or all these stripping of union rights from federal workers and layoffs happening at the same time, which of course is going to have devastating effects for people, fellow workers, of course, that we have deep sympathy with, whether they're janitors, whether they're just like low-level staffers in agencies, obviously working-class people just like ourselves who are going to be affected very deeply by this entire thing. Not so much maybe all the contractors that live out in like the D.C. suburbs, but that's not what we're talking about, right? That's not what we're talking about when we're talking about D.C. So I guess like we kind of talked today about what DC has been, what it is right now, what it might possibly be in the future, how it's perhaps a harbinger, you know, of what's coming for the rest of us. And then we also talked about kind of what the political, broader political landscape is in reaction to that. And it's dire. It's fucking bleak, folks. It's pretty bad out there. But I wonder maybe some parting words, if you would talk again about the mutual aid and sort of civil, social, and like scene institutions that kind of helped DC come out of the bad days of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and how you think that we all might benefit from that in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I'll start by talking about the mutual aid organizations that are doing good on the ground work there now. One that I keep feeling really impressed with is an org called Remora House, R-E-M-O-R-A. And they've been doing, you know, deliveries of necessities to encampments. They've been helping to coordinate, you know, putting up displaced homeless people in hotel rooms, helping them, you know, figure out administrative stuff, which is really hard to figure out when you're sleeping outside. And, you know, of course, one of the day one things that all these feds had to do was sweep the encampments. So that means a lot of displaced people right now. So they're doing really good work there. I'll say, too, DC Migrant Mutual Aid, or the Migrant Mutual Aid Solidarity Network. It's something like that. They have been really instrumental with Ice Watch. They've been really good with coordinating, you know, court responses for people getting swept up by ICE. And they, excuse me, they just seem to really be doing God's work down there. And they're one of the funds that I donated, to when I did that fundraiser. Similar with Ward 2 Mutual Aid. They are another org that's, you know, helping to make important life or death arrangements for displaced homeless people in DC. And they're the other org that I donated to from my fundraiser. If you go to Union Station, to DC's Union Station now, as you're leaving the station, I think this is still ongoing. There's an organization called FLARE, F-L-A-R-E, and they've got like a tent set up. And if you show up there and are looking for, you know, where you can be of service, they can give you information. They can get you where you need to go. which I think is just a really cool, important, helpful thing. They've been really helpful in an organizational way. And, you know, I could keep going. I could rattle off like names of these outfits all day long. But what I think is more important to emphasize is the specific things that they are doing, because I think something that's really discouraging for people who, you know, they're looking to offer friendship and solidarity within their communities, but it's such an overwhelming thing and you don't know where to start. And these are really pretty simple things that anyone can do. Like, anyone can arrange packing up supplies and like finding local encampments or people who just might need them and bringing them over and, you know, asking, do you need some of this stuff? Is there something else that you need? And even more than just delivering stuff as if it's charity, forming that relationship. And I think we should all be looking for ways to, you know, to look beyond, let me give a little bit of money and then it's out of my hands, and to look for ways to like make your money go farther and also to form the relationship and to recognize $10 is a drop in the bucket for an NGO. I don't even know where it would go. They're not specific about it.
Nine of it would go to their coffers. One might end up in someone else's. Yeah.
If you Venmo the $10 to Remora House or Food Not Bombs, you know that that's, you know, buying something important at CVS, or it's buying food for a meal, and you can be really specific with it. And then, you know, as it goes further and further, or I guess closer and closer to you, you know more and more what your work and your money is going to, right down to if you're forming those relationships yourself. Not only can you, you know what this person needs, they know what you need when the time comes. Because I think we need to move beyond this model of like community care being something that we magnanimously offer to other people.
Charity work. Good works, right?
Right, exactly. A very Christian model. It's community care. It's something that like other people are going to be offering to you one day. And I think that beyond receiving charity, offering help is one of the most like, I mean, if I can be corny, one of the most spiritually important things a person could be doing. And I think, you know, if we can give other people the chance to help us, that's a really big deal. And it goes a long way towards making those bonds permanent. And you see it in DC everywhere. Like, these are tight-knit communities. Most of my friends who I've had for years and years still live there. And, you know, we pick up like it's nothing because we know each other so well. And I think that's the most important thing we can be doing to, you know, take the long view and improve things for all of us, is to really make a point of getting to know each other, getting to know what each other needs, and like offering it when we can and taking it when we need to.
Thank you for that. And I would say too, on the theme of, as a last thing to say, because I'm not gonna be long-winded here, on the theme of the, if we can call it, the DCification of the rest of the country, right?
Sorry guys.
Coming to a town near you, town or city near you. Now is a good time to like join an organization or form an organization. I'm not going to be partisan here. Join the DSA, your local DSA chapter. Join or create a local ILC chapter. Become involved in independent socialist initiatives, communist initiatives, anarchist initiatives where you are, because these things are only going to be more and more important. And these great scenes and milieus and institutions that came out of DC in the 70s and 80s, right, as Rax has talked about, are instrumental nowadays in helping people try to navigate this very terrible moment. And we need that all over the country.
Yeah, and I think the last thing I'll say to all that is I read, I think, in the New York Times about what's going on in DC, and I honestly don't even remember what the point of the thing I read was, but I remember at some point it said, you know, some of the flaws of the activist response in DC right now appear to be that there's not a lot of mass protest and there aren't clear leaders. And, you know, I'm not an expert on this sort of thing, but I think we're starting to come up against the limits of mass protest as Americans have to practice it, like approved, permitted protest. 5 years ago, the protest really came to a boiling point and we were like brutally repressed. And I think this is a good time, while we're regrouping, to not just regroup in order to like protest again, but to also, you know, do the less sexy stuff of making food for your homeless neighbors and of, you know, packing those boxes of supplies and of being together in these smaller ways. Because I think that for all that it's not glamorous, these small groups of people with you know, a shared mission are able to get more done in a real way than a flashy protest. Mm-hmm.
No, I think that's right. And as much as we agree, workers over billionaires, the time for mass rallies might come again. But I think you're right. It's good to take a couple steps back. So with that, thank you, Rax King, for your return to this podcast. It's been many times, but it'll be many more after that. Thank you and solidarity to you and all your people in D.C.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening.
One more time, and I roll. Good to see you, Mr. Tiger. One more time. What's that big winner from Petersburg?